Hello and welcome to Dear 21-Year-Old Me, where we go back in time and reflect on our guest's 21st birthday and delve into the life lessons they've learned along the way that's made them the leader that they are today. I'm Jeremy Irvine, and it is great to have you along. Our guest today is Doug Weller. Doug is founder, director, and senior media trainer at Corporate Media Services. He's also a former journalism educator and journalist and broadcaster, including having been ABC Australia's Washington correspondent in the early 1990s. Now, a disclosure. Associations that I've led have been Doug's media training clients in the past, and I tell you what, he puts you through your paces. But Doug's fascinating media background, and including his own background, have resonated with me. And as I began to put together a list of people that I wanted to get on this show, it was a no-brainer in asking Doug along. And as you'll hear, I am really glad that I did. He has some fascinating stories. But before we meet Doug, let's look at the year he turned 21, 1977. Australia's population is 14 million. In 2022, it's now just over 26 million people. Sir John Kerr, he of the Whitlam dismissal fame, resigns while the Australian Democrats are formed. In Sydney, 83 people die in the Granville train disaster, Australia's worst ever rail disaster. And we thank ABBA for their music as they began their Australian tour. And talking of music, Advance Australia Fair wins a national plebiscite for Australia's national song, winning 43% of the vote. Federally, Malcolm Fraser's Liberal National Government is returned, and Joe Bjelke-Petersen's national government in Queensland wins its fourth successive victory. Music TV show Countdown. Remember, Countdown reaches 100 episodes, and we farewelled cop show Homicide, which had been on air at that stage since 1964. Star Wars opens and becomes the highest grossing film for the next 5 years. In 1977, Elvis Presley dies and the first Apple II series computers go on sale. And it's a year of draws in Australian sport. St George and Parramatta in the New South Wales Rugby League, and North Melbourne and Collingwood playing out a draw in the VFL, with North being the victors in the following week, while St George come back the following week in their grand final, thrashing the Eels 22-0. Overseas, Jimmy Carter sworn in as president, while tragedy strikes in the Canary Islands when two jets collide, killing 583 people, the deadliest aviation accident in history. What a year 1977 was. And it's the year our guest, Doug Weller, turned 21. Doug, welcome. What do you recall of the year that you turned 21, which was 1977? What were you doing, and how did you get to be what you were doing?
Well, I was 21. I was in Longridge in Western Queensland. I was a radio announcer. I'd just broken into the industry, which was very hard to actually get into. I was feeling a bit sorry for myself because I was away from family and friends. I'd just arrived in Longridge, went to the pub with some other radio announcers from the radio station where I was working, 4LG at Longridge. They said after a few beers, oh, let's go around to Sanso's house. So I went around to this person's house and I walked through the door and everybody screamed, surprise. And I thought, it's a surprise birthday party. I wonder who that's for. It was for me.
That's fantastic.
So I've got vivid memories of all of that. But the journey to actually getting to that particular situation when I was 21 and I was actually working in the broadcast industry. Yeah. High school wasn't great for me, a young gay kid at high school. In those days, you weren't called gay, you were called a fairy. Nothing to turn up home with a black eye. It was really tough. So After I left school, I didn't go on to uni at that stage and get a degree. That would all come later. I decided to do a trade because the messages from adults then were, get a trade under your belt. Yeah. You'll never be without a job if you get a trade under your belt.
Yeah.
Went off, did a trade, and the trade I chose was saddle making.
No.
Now, not a tenterfield saddler, but a saddler
just across the border.
I think what was going on, my brother, you know, we're from a rural area outside Brisbane. I had a horse, my dad had a horse, my brother, all his mates had horses. And I think the conversation was, let's convince Doug to be a saddle maker, we'll get cheap saddles. But my first day on the job, I thought, well, I've made a terrible mistake here. I remember looking at the clock up on the wall at the saddle making facility and waiting for 4 o'clock to come, knock off time. And I remember thinking, oh, this is clock watching, where you watch the clock because you just want to get out of there. So after a couple of weeks, I thought, well, I don't really want to do this. And I went off to be a pastry cook, which was a bit more up my alley, and I enjoyed it a bit more, but it wasn't my dream job. And the years roll along, and I turn 20. And I'm basically drifting. I'm working at the Hamilton Hotel in Brisbane as a waiter behind the bar and as a waiter in the dining room. And I enjoyed that, working with, you know, fun people, people my own age, you know, meeting customers. Most of them were pretty nice. And so I was just sort of drifting along at age 20, working at the Hamilton Hotel in Brisbane. One day I get a phone call from my boss. Can you work tonight? Somebody's sick. Can you do the shift? And I was free, so I went in and I filled in. And partway through the evening, a couple of larger-than-life individuals come in from radio station 4IP, Colour Radio 4IP, which at that time in Brisbane was the radio station. Number one, I listened to it constantly. My brother, my mates all listened to it. It was the radio station to listen to when you were 20. Knew all the radio announcers, knew all the songs. And these two larger-than-life individuals walk in, and they're radio announcers from 4IP, with 4IP branding all over their T-shirts, all over their jackets, very 70s hair. Their wives are with them, very 70s hair. I mean, these people made an impact, and I was just delighted. It was like seeing a couple of rock stars. I mean, I was just over the moon. So I immediately went over and found a table and got them seated and took their drinks order, and chatting to them during the evening, and they were lots of fun. They're very friendly, very chatty. And I dropped a round of drinks off. I can still remember doing it. And I asked a question just to make conversation.
Right.
I asked a question that would change my life.
What was that question?
I said, so how do you get into the broadcasting industry? Uh-huh. And from the moment I asked that question, my life would never be the same.
Wow. So that was a huge sliding door moment for you very early
huge.
On, wasn't it?
Huge. Huge. And, you know, they told me about their experiences. They told me about an organization called the Institute of Radio and Television Production based in Brisbane. I'd never heard of it. I can remember driving home from the pub that night thinking, I have got to find out about this. I was so fired up after chatting to these guys. They were wonderful. They were really positive. And they said, oh, you know, ring the Institute, see if you can get in, do one of the courses. The next day, went to the phone book. Of course, there was no Google in those days, so I went to the phone book, found the number, rang through. The course for that year was full.
Yeah.
And after that, I just rang every day and said, has anybody pulled out? You sure you can't take me on? I just badgered them. And I think eventually they felt sorry for me. I either annoyed the living daylights out of them or they just felt sorry for me. Right. And I got into the next course.
So, ticks for persistence early on then for Mr. Well.
I just keep going. I thought, I'll just ring every day because surely somebody is going to pull out. And I think my dad said, just keep at it, keep ringing. We didn't have a phone on at home, so I'd have to go down the post office and put my sixpence in and ring up. And I think they just got to know me and they just thought, well, we'll just let this kid in. So, did
you
the first
walking
night
in the first day for the first part of the course?
Yeah, the first course was introductory meet and greet. It was in the evening and it was at 4IP. And I'm walking into this radio station that I knew all about.
Yeah.
There was music in the background. Everybody was up and happy and really positive. Yeah. And I thought, oh, this is great. And I started chatting to some of the other guys, went in for the introductory session. Mm-hmm. The Institute was run by two people, Jim Iliffe, who was a TV personality that I'd known my whole life in Brisbane, and John Knox, who was the senior newsreader at 4IP. So these were the two directors, very friendly guys, very up guys. And everybody spoke to you like you were going to get a job in the industry. Uh-huh. It was just when you get into this industry, when you get a job, when you actually break into this industry, there was no if, it was when. And the first night I just sat there thinking, this is the greatest thing I have ever come across in my life. I left just thinking, this is wonderful. I couldn't wait for the next session. I was just so fired up by the fact that I was doing something really interesting and I was surrounded by people who were really positive.
And all like you, just wanting to get in and do and learn.
Yeah, Young guys who were just trying to find their way in life. What is their, you know, people had done trades or they'd been to uni and they dropped out. And we're all discussing where we were at age 20, not even thinking this is probably the most significant period of my life, but just enjoying the moment, enjoying the course and enjoying everybody who was part of the course.
What did Dad think about all this as you've gone from being an apprentice saddler to a pastry cook, and then obviously working at the Hamilton?
I think he was trying to go, okay, what's the link here? Saddle making, pastry cooking, radio announcer. He's trying to find the link because I had never mentioned anything about broadcasting. I'd never mentioned anything about journalism or news and current affairs. Even though my dad was a major influence when it came to news and current affairs, Dad would watch the 7 p.m. ABC News with me each night. We'd watch current affairs programs. He'd discuss it with me. I have very happy memories of sitting at the kitchen table with my dad. My mum had passed away when I was 5 years old, so the family was my dad, my brother, my older brother, and I. Yep. And our very happy memories sitting at the kitchen table, reading from front to back the Daily Telegraph, which at the time was the afternoon newspaper in Brisbane, and just chatting about news and information. I remember when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. You probably weren't even born then, Jeremy.
No comment.
Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, and I contacted Dad, and I said, "Oh, we're getting the day off school today because Neil Armstrong's landed on the moon." And he said, "Make sure, mate, you go home and you turn on the TV and you watch absolutely every single part of that, and don't leave the TV. Make sure you watch all of it." And so I went home and I did what I was told and I sat and I watched it. So I had this news and current affairs influence, you know, going back to, you know, when I was a kid because my dad was a major influence in that regard.
How then did you end up at 4LG?
So I go from saddle making to pastry cooking to the pub to meeting the radio announcers to doing the course, and I finish the course, then the hard stuff starts. It's okay, how do you get into this industry? This is not an easy industry to get into. Everybody's been really positive, but it's hard to break in. Yeah. John Knox, one of the directors of the Institute, organized an interview for me at Toowoomba. Did the interview, didn't get the job, really disappointed. Went for another interview for another radio station, didn't get the job. Mm. I thought, okay, how do I break into this industry? This is going to be hard. I need to get myself in front of people. So what I did was I had a Holden station wagon with a mattress in the back and curtains. They used to call them sin bins, but they were a very effective mode of transport, let me tell you. Right. So you could pull up anywhere and, you know, get a good night's sleep. So I thought, I'll drive my Holden station wagon from our farm just outside of Brisbane. I'll drive from Brisbane down to Canberra going the coast road. And then I'll drive from the inland road from Canberra back up to Brisbane or back home at the farm. And I will call in at every radio station I can come across on the way, ring through, see if I can get an interview and get myself in front of people and tell them that I'm keen to get into the industry. And so that's what I did. That's what I did. So
it was like a road trip to get into radio.
Right. Thank you. That's it, a road trip to get into radio. I'd get to the local town. I'd go to the post office. I'd hear the radio, obviously, on the car radio as I was driving in. I'd ring. Generally, I'd be able to get to see somebody. I'd change into my good gear in the back of the station wagon. In I'd go. Did that all the way to Canberra. Met any number of people all the way back to the inland road. Got back. No job. No calls. Nothing happened. Back to the Hamilton Hotel, pulling beers, complaining endlessly to my colleagues who were very good, patting me on the back. And then John Knox rang me one day and said, "How's it all going?" And I said, "No good." And he said, "I want you to meet a guy called Alan Brandt." We call him AB.
Okay.
Alan Brandt was the general manager of Colour Radio, the Colour Radio 4IP network, which was 4IP in Brisbane, radio stations in Warwick, Longreach, Charleville and Mount Isa. "I want you to go and see AB." And I thought, oh, okay, this is it. There's any number of possibilities here. I'll just go in and I will, you know, get this job. John's put a good word in for me. In I go, sit next to AB's lovely personal assistant, Margaret, and she was smiling at me and I was very nervous. So I was smiling at her. AB comes out, huge man, booming voice, come on in. I sit down. I've got all my paperwork and everything's ready to roll. Wasn't interested in that. He got an old recorder, put it in front of me, tape recorder, hit the record button, handed me a Mather's shoe commercial because he wanted to hear what my voice was like, handed me a Mather's shoe commercial and said, read that. Now, I'm 20. I'm as nervous as all. Get out. Yeah. This is going to be my big moment. I'm holding a piece of A4 paper, and if you're nervous, anybody will know if you're nervous and holding a piece of A4 paper, it's bouncing all over the place. Could hardly read what I was reading. Halfway through reading it, he stopped it. He pulled the recorder back. He said to me, look, I'll be honest with you. You're not very good. I've had people in here today who are much better than you. Look, you don't have much ability and you don't have much of a future in broadcasting. And really, by being here, you're wasting your time and mine. Thanks for coming.
Wow.
Open the door and out I went.
Oh, and how deflating and completely
shattered.
Awful.
Yeah. This was it. After all the attempts, this was it.
Yeah. Plus went the road trip from Gabbert.
The road trip, you know, waste of time. The car broke down. Believe it or not, near Tenterfield, we had to get the car fixed. So I'm thinking, well, what do I actually do now? I was in the kitchen that night. My brother's there and he's furious and he's going to do this and he's going to do that. And my father's trying to calm my brother down. He's trying to, you know, keep me on the steady and cooked here at the same time. So back to the pub and thinking, what do I do now? Yeah. John Knox calls me. How did it go? No good. Okay. Yeah. A couple of weeks later, John rings me again. Oh. I want you to go back and see AB. And I went, you've got to be joking.
Oh, wow.
He goes, no, I want you to go back and see AB I want you to have another interview. And I said, John, I can't do this. This is crazy. This is insanity. He told me not to come back, said I was hopeless. He said, don't worry about that. Just go back and see him. What John knew, what I didn't know, was that the one thing that AB admired above anything else was persistence.
Ah, right. Okay.
Had a little spiel in his office up in the corner, persistence will. And I didn't know any of this. So I go back. I sit next to Margaret, who's lovely, and she looks at me smiling, and I look at her, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? And the only reason I went back is because my mentor at the time, John Knox, said, you've got to go back. I'm sitting there for what seems like an eternity. The door opens, and it's AB.
Oh, yeah.
And very huge man, big booming voice. He goes, you again? I said, yes. You were in here a couple of weeks ago. Yes. I told you not to come back. I said you weren't much chop. Yes. But Mr. Brand, I was talking to John Knox and he said, and he cut me off, he said, can you be at Charleville in Western Queensland by 6 o'clock tomorrow night?
Oh.
And as quick as a flash, I said, yep. He said, okay, we'll give you a go. Margaret will give you all the details. And
just
shut
like
the door.
That.
Yep.
So I looked no at more Margaret. Auditions?
No more auditions. Margaret looked at me with an envelope full of all the details and said, congratulations, everything's in the envelope, drive carefully. I was in.
That was it.
I made it.
Yay.
I made it.
Fantastic. How good was the drive home to tell dad and brother?
Well, my dad worked at a travel bureau down the road and I ran down and it was an international travel bureau and there were people in there, I'm sure, booking their Women's Weekly World Discovery Tour. And I ran in screaming and yelling and the women who worked for dad knew all about the situation and they were excited and dad was in a state of shock and you could see these people who wanted to book their holiday thinking, who is this out of control kid going crazy? Raced home, tried to contact my brother. I don't think I was able to get in contact with him. Didn't have the phone on at home, so I just jumped in the car because I had to be there by the next night. Threw everything in the back of the Holden station wagon. Not much, Jeremy, when you're 20. Not much at all, but worldly possessions in the back of the van. Yeah. Off to Charleville to start my radio announcing career.
So how long, for those of us who don't, well, A, aren't an Australian, B, aren't necessarily au fait with Western Queensland geography, how long is that back in 19?
It's about 700-800 kilometres, so it's around about an 8 to 10 hour drive and, you know, very, very dry, very straight out.
Right. So that's like driving from Melbourne to Sydney with a bit of, you know,
Yeah, but not much to see along the way.
No, well, it's a long way.
But it was a great drive, and I'm just thinking that I'm king of the castle and over the moon, because I finally managed to I couldn't care less where I started, and I was just so happy to be in the industry.
So you've ended up in Charleville, and then how did we end up at 4L to start with?
Well, Charleville was basically at the bottom of the rung, and so you started in Charleville, and after a few months there, they said, okay, we want to send you off to Longridge, which was seen as a promotion. So there I was in Longridge about to turn 21.
Do you remember pinching yourself when you walked into your first paid radio gig? Or how did you feel the moment you walked into for your first on-air session?
I remember pulling up in Charleville, even though it was a long time ago, and just being so excited. And I didn't know really where the radio station was. I had a bit of an idea, found it, walked up the stairs, and I thought, I'm walking into the rest of my life. This is the industry that I want to be involved in. I didn't know where it was going to go. But, of course, it's a very small crew. There was a manager, four radio announcers, two office people. They knew I was coming. They were very welcoming. They were terrific. One of the first people I met was a guy called Tony Wigan, who is still doing radio today. He's on community radio in Toowoomba. We've been mates ever since I walked into the radio station. So I'm making friendships that literally are lasting a lifetime, and just really excited to begin, you know, my radio career.
You've had an incredible career. You've obviously started in radio, and as we'll come to in a little bit, and then worked your way through different organisations, and then into being an educator, and obviously now as a media trainer, where you and I met some years back. Just very quickly, how did you end up doing what you've done? You've gone from regional radio to essentially being a foreign correspondent in not a long period of time, to running a quite successful media training company.
Yeah, I guess it was step by step. You know, I went from Charleville to Longridge, Longridge to Mount Isa. Mount Isa had a news editor. Now, the news editor was the news cadet, the news researcher, and swept the floor. But there was somebody, one of the radio announcers, was responsible for news. And I thought, that's the job I want. I want that news position. This is where I want to go. And I thought that very early in the piece. This is what I want to do. How do I get to be a journalist? How do I actually do this? So it's a very slow process. When I got to Mount Isa, a few weeks after I got there, the news editor, in inverted commas, left. I said to the boss, I want the news job. And he said, well, you can have it, Dougie. Nobody else wants it. And so I became the news guy, and I expanded the radio news bulletins and the current affairs radio news bulletins, but I still didn't have a cadetship, and I needed a cadetship. So I had to get to a city-based radio station big enough where I could actually start my cadetship. And I thought, who do I know in a city-based radio station who could give me a job as a cadet? AB, Alan Brand, had gone from 4IP to 4KQ, that is trying to improve because it was pretty low on the ratings. So I shot off a letter to AB. We used to send letters in those days, not emails. Shot off a letter. Lo and behold, he contacts me, offers me the cadetship. I start my cadetship at 4KQ. Our sister station then, in terms of swapping news over in Sydney, was 2WS, was bigger than Ben Hur. Just started. After a couple of years at 4KQ, the guys at 2WS, we dealt with them a lot, said, oh, we've got a C-grade journalism job going. Do you want to apply for it? Apply for it, got that. Did the rounds of the Sydney newsrooms, 2GB, 2UE, came back to Queensland to have a break from the industry because it's pretty full on. Yeah. And I thought, I'd really like to work at the ABC. I think that ABC, when it comes to broadcast news and current affairs, is it. That's where you want to be. I'd like to work at the ABC. So I rang the ABC in Brisbane, spoke to the news editor there. There were no jobs available. And so he said he would keep me in touch, rang the next day, 2 days casual work. And I said, yeah, look, I can do that. So I did two days casual work, and I was there for the next 13 years.
And, again, was that part in some part because of your persistence, getting on the phone, getting known, getting in front of people and being positive about, look, I can come in.
Just picking up the phone and making the call. Yeah. I thought, okay, how do I actually do this? Well, I'll just pick up the phone and I'll speak to this person. And I said, I'll go in. He said, there's no need. We don't have any positions. And if he hadn't called back so quickly, I probably would have run the next week and the next week and the next week.
How did you end up in DC then? So you've done your commercial radio throughout regional Queensland, and then obviously 4KQ, and then in, you know, 2GB and 2UE, you know, two behemoths of Sydney radio, and then to the ABC. You've ended up in DC at an incredibly important time in not only American history but also world history.
Well, there was a lot going on in Queensland at that particular time. So you had the Joe for PM campaign. You had the Fitzgerald inquiry into corruption. I went from the ABC newsroom in Brisbane to Current Affairs Radio, which is AM, the World Today, and PM, because a vacancy came up there. I was still casual in the newsroom. I went over there, gained a permanent position there. And so 1989 came along, and I'd been, really busy in Brisbane, lots of really interesting stories, national stories. Towards the end of 89, the internal bulletin at the ABC came around, and they were advertising overseas jobs internally. There was a job in Washington. There was a job in London. I think there was a job in the Middle East. I'd always thought of applying for these jobs, and I looked at it, and I thought, should I put in my application? And I thought, well, why not? You know, I spent my whole life of going, well, why not?
Why not?
Give it a go. So I threw my hat into the ring, put in my application, not really thinking I would get one of these jobs, but I thought I can start the process now.
Yep.
Almost had forgotten about it. The phone rings a couple of weeks later, and I'm asked, would I like to be the ABC Washington correspondent?
Was that
and I'm just blown away.
Blown away. I was going to say, was that almost like the conversation you had with AB and Margaret out the front of his office?
Another moment where you just get blown away. You're just absolutely stunned. I mean, it's a senior position, and, you know, you hope you will gain these positions.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think everybody, when they apply for a job like that, they try to soften the blow by convincing themselves they won't get it. And I didn't expect to get it. And I was offered the position. And, of course, I was over the moon. I was nervous. I was thrilled. I was concerned. But that was it. That was the moment, the end of 89.
You're in DC at the start of Operation Desert Shield and then Desert Storm, which
– Yes.
Incredibly important time. And then you were there obviously reporting from the White House and Pentagon and Congress. There were some very, very strong leaders during that time. And I'm not talking necessarily political, but I'm referring to in some point Colin Powell, who was at the time the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and you would have seen him briefing the media. What lessons did you take from watching and contextualizing what was being said? And were you aware of what was going on? You know, you were basically reporting on history at that point in time?
Yeah, you are aware of the significance of the story, because, you know, America is about and the Allies are about to go to war. And so you are, or as they call it, the coalition, you are aware of the significance of it, but you're so busy day to day, you're not really thinking about the people who are involved. But you mentioned Colin Powell. I mean, you know, what a leader. Very, very clear in his messaging, very good at handling very difficult press conferences. I mean, you just left a press conference with him, you know, feeling that this person knew what he was on about. This is a leader in a very, very tough situation, but very clear about what he needs to achieve, and the messages that would come out that had to go to the American public were absolutely clear. There was no mucking about, and I think that's one of the most important things when it comes to leadership.
Right.
Know what you want to say and say it clearly, and make sure those clear messages get through to the audience you're chasing. And, you know, he's a fantastic example of somebody who is not only a great leader, but a great communicator.
And is it fair to say, and I say this as someone who's gone through the ring with you on a number of times doing some media training.
Yes,
over the
years. Put you under the pump occasionally. Sorry about that, Jeremy.
No, that's okay.
It was for a good cause.
Yeah, I'm still recovering from the last one, actually. But that's why we have you, because you're great at what you do. But in all seriousness, I actually still am recovering from the last one. And it was about 3 years ago. But in all seriousness, did that frame a lot of the way that you ended up becoming a journalism educator and now media trainer by looking at people like Power going, right, this is the clear way, this is the way to communicate and with clarity and decisiveness and that strength of communication?
Look, I fell into lecturing at uni. I'd done some media training before that when I was working at the ABC, just, you know, off and on, and I really enjoyed it. I just enjoyed the education process. I was always amazed at how, you know, the little amount of people knew about media communications, and it's great to be able to say to people, look, here's what it's all about. So I just enjoyed the education part of the whole process. Left the ABC. A job came up at RMIT, and I wanted to lecture. I thought that'd be great. By that stage, I've got my degree, so I go off and I lecture for 8 years. And I just enjoyed the education process, and I followed through from that university situation into my current role, which is teaching adults how to communicate with the media. I see teaching at university and media training in very much the same way. It is teaching people how to actually, at uni, how to actually get a job as a journalist, but in media training, how to actually communicate effectively to small audiences, larger audiences, and media audiences. And it is a teaching process. And I just love teaching.
When you're watching TV, when you're listening to the radio as a media consumer these days, from two perspectives, do you critique what you're being given in terms of a journalist and a broadcaster by trade? And the second part of this question is, do you also then critique the way the answers are being given by politician, industry person, union head, for example?
Look, unfortunately, yes, to the horror of, you know, my partner and my children. I'm always making comments. Jeremy, I'm afraid I don't have a life. I do watch a lot of news and current affairs and I unpack it. I love seeing, you know, people performing well, and it just frustrates me when I see people performing badly. So, yeah, I do get a lot of joy out of still observing media, print, radio, TV, online, but especially watching TV and listening to radio and unpacking people's situations and looking at where they've done a great job and where they haven't done a great job. And it does frustrate me when people are simply not communicating effectively. They're not doing what they need to do as leaders, and they're not coming across the way they should come across.
What leadership lessons throughout your career have you, you know, you talked about now the late Colin Powell, for example. Are there other leaders you've looked at and gone, that's how you do it?
Yeah, look, I've had some great people that I've worked with in the ABC who really fantastic people. The late Jock Rankin, fantastic bloke. Right. And Jock could just, you know, gather a crew around him who are loyal to him because he was such a strong leader. He not only spoke about what needed to be done, he had done it. Maxine McHugh was my boss at the Press Gallery in Canberra. Same situation with Max. I mean, you just couldn't help admire these people. Ian Henderson, former day editor and newsreader on the ABC. The late Paul Murphy, who fronted a PM. I mean, these,
of course, yes.
These people are just fantastic people, and it's just great to be around them, and it's just great to be with them. Peter Ryan, who I worked with for years and is still the a senior economics correspondent for the ABC. Yeah. Peter's been my boss in the past. Very, very confident people, very knowledgeable people. They know what they're on about and they communicate effectively. And you just can't do anything else but admire them because they are good leaders. They lead well. They lead from the front. They communicate well.
Walk us through what it was actually like being a foreign correspondent. You know, what did you have a bag packed? Did you, was it a drop of the moment, away you go and you've got to go to the other side of the country? Or so how did it, what was life like living in DC for you?
Look, DC is a power city, and you realize that from the moment you actually get there. Some foreign correspondents are out the door with 2 seconds' notice. That's not the case in Washington. You have an amount of notice before you travel off with the president, right. And you've got time to actually get your head around the issues of the day. But you know. Desert, you mentioned, you know, Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Desert Shield occurred about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning in Washington. I get a phone call. I remember the editor that called me said, "Mate, you've got to get into the shop. Saddam Hussein is 20 miles outside of Kuwait." And I'll always remember that. Get into the shop. But you know that I mean, that was the story. You had to get in there, and you had to actually cover it. I think that the real challenge is getting your head around all of the issues when you're in those positions. I made friends with the BBC foreign correspondent, or the latest BBC foreign correspondent to be posted just after I got to Washington. Right. And I remember he said to me, I said, "Gee, it's a lot to get your head around and there's a lot to do." And he said, "What I say to the BBC is give me 3 months. I'll just do reports. I'll say what's going on, but I won't do any analysis pieces for 3 months. After 3 months, it's all good. I'm fair game." So he just basically said, "Give me 3 months to settle in before I do the hard stuff." And I was lucky. I got there in the January, and Desert, the invasion of Kuwait happened August 2, 1990. So I had, you know, 6 months or thereabouts to get my head around Washington. Then I had to get my head around the Middle East,
which is a hugely complex issue, not only culturally but historically, geographically, economically, aren't they?
Yeah, look, it's a huge story, and you know that it's a huge story. The good thing is, you know, you just need a few good people to help you in those situations. I had a researcher, Laura, who was just fantastic, and she would give you what you needed for the day even before you asked for it. I worked with great people such as Heather Hewitt and John Cameron, a former head of ABC News. And I mean, you're working with these people, you're discussing it each day. CNN is on constantly. In those days, you had the teleprinter going crazy. So you just lived that story and you watched every part of it. So you are actually able to be across it. You didn't get much sleep, but you're able to be across it. So when George Bush would go off to the Middle East and try and shore up the coalition, and we'd go off and follow him around, you had a good idea of what the story was and what was actually going to happen. And you could write a lot of the stories off the top of your head, which was good because you just were absolutely flat out.
You've come back to Australia and then been posted to Melbourne from memory. I have watched clips of you, which I think kindly have been posted on YouTube somewhere by your kids.
Kindly or unkindly, yes.
And then hello to Daniel and Leah. But they've posted some clips of you reading the ABC TV news here in Melbourne. Tell us about the last couple of minutes before a news bulletin goes to air and your first live bulletin interview, because you've been trained in radio and then in Radio Current Affairs, which I assume back in those days that you were working at the ABC was, it was radio, it was TV, it wasn't, you know, across both.
Yes, mainly radio. Yeah, little bit of TV, but mainly radio. Yep.
So my question is in three parts. How did you learn how to read auto cue? How nervous were you? And how relieved were you when the director said, "And we're out"?
You're very relieved when they say, "That's it," and go there and have a cup of tea or a beer. Look, I just, once again, I'm working at the press gallery. I actually came back from Washington to the press gallery in Canberra. I was at the press gallery in Canberra chatting to the team at the front desk after a busy day. They showed me the green guide and said, "Job going for a program called First Edition based in Melbourne. Why don't you put in for it?" And I said, "Oh, really? Give me a look." And I thought, "Oh, well, no, I don't think I'd get that." But once again, I thought, toss my hat into the ring. You never know your luck. Yep. Put in for it, came down to Melbourne. Jock Rankin was head of news and current affairs down here. Jill Singer, the late Jill Singer, was the EP. Yep. I came down and everybody's doing their run-throughs in the studio, and I thought, what? It was a bit like sitting in front of AB. What am I doing here? this is a national news and current affairs program I'm putting in for here. But yeah. I thought, oh, well. So I go in and I sit in the studio. So they give you a bit of a run through. I never actually sat in a TV studio and looked at an auto cue, and there was the auto cue
right
in front of me. Right. And
they didn't teach you that for LG, did they?
Certainly. I mean, I learned a lot in Longreach, but I didn't learn the auto cue. So I look at the auto cue and I think, I remember saying, I'm sorry, could somebody tell me, how do we make the words go up? Because it just had on the auto cue,
yeah.
Good afternoon, my name's Doug Weller, welcome to the program, and the first line of the next one. And this delightful woman sitting in the corner said, oh, I do that.
Oh.
And I went, oh, okay, so... So I've got to keep up with you? She said, oh, no, I keep up with you.
Right.
And I went, okay. And that was a bit unnerving because I thought, well, I'm not doing anything here. I'm just sitting and this person is used, but you very quickly get used to all of the supports that are around you. And of course they know so much more about it than you do.
Right.
And so I sat in there and I did my best and I thought it was appalling. And I walked out of the studio and Jill walked up to me and said, that was fantastic. Would you move to Melbourne? And I was like, huh? She introduced me to Jock Rankin, who was fantastic. And, and I thought, do I have this job? And I thought, no, surely not. Go back to the Canberra Press Gallery a few days later. The phone rings. We want you to come down and front first edition, the first morning breakfast program on ABC TV.
So it's a long, long ancestor of News Breakfast.
It is indeed, yeah. And that program in its current form is still going, which is fantastic.
Very quickly, day one of first edition. 3, 2, 1. How nervous were you in the last couple of 10 seconds?
Oh, terrible.
Or was it? Right. Okay.
Terrible. Okay. Although this is another fine mess I've got myself into. Just
could
terrible.
Could have been making saddles, Doug.
Could have been cooking rock buns. What, this is another mess I've got myself into. I remember being ferociously nervous and uptight, but you just eventually, what I say to myself, advice I gave students at uni was that you simply say to yourself, well, this is going to happen.
Yep.
I'm not going to not turn up. This is actually going to happen. So I can either do a half-decent job or I can do a terrible job. So just go in there and give it your best shot, because that's all you can ever do is give anything your best shot. But I remember getting very little sleep the night before. I worked with a fantastic person, Kate Dunstan, who had a lot of TV experience, and Kate was very good at reassuring me everything would be okay. You know, 15 minutes into it, you're reading the audio cue and you think, yeah, okay, this seems to be coming together.
Yeah.
Okay. You do the next one, then the next one, then the next one, and then you get very comfortable with sitting in a studio with lights in your eyes and makeup on your face reading from an audio cue. It's just one of those things that you finally – get used to. It's a bit like riding a bike. And then after that program, going into the newsroom and learning how the newsroom operated, you occasionally be reading the news. It was not easy, but it just wasn't as daunting as it was the first time round. And I think your confidence grows.
Yeah.
And again, you think, okay, the news is going to air. It's 5 to 7. News goes to air at 7. I'm a bit nervous. Well, don't get nervous. That'll just mess up the show.
Yeah.
Just get in there and do it. Just do it.
Do newsreaders have their own style? I mean, every presenter's got their own style. Anyone behind a microphone's got their own style. Did you look at other presenters around the world, you know, particularly overseas, and go, that's how I would like to try to come across, or is it just, I'm just going to do my own thing and see how I
go? No. It was basically, let's get through this next bulletin and do a half-decent job.
Yeah.
I think if I did it for a longer time, you might try and, you know, have a certain style. I remember being explained to me the first week I was doing it by one of the producers, spoke about, you know, getting your own style. And I'm thinking, I think I'll just survive for the next couple of months before I start thinking about a style. I mean, you just get in there and you do what you think is going to be appropriate, and you do what you think is going to be right, and you're asking people for feedback, and they give you feedback. So it is daunting, but it's just a case of going in there, getting the job done, trying to make sure that you aren't stumbling through the whole process, trying to make sure that you're across the auto queue, that you've got your paperwork in front of you in case the auto queue goes down, and getting through to the end of the bulletin. But you're quite right, Jeremy. You are very pleased when you say, "That's all for tonight. Have a great night. Good night." Good night. And smile. You're off. You go, "Thank God for that."
Right. And then the taxpayer cup of tea comes out and you go, "Thank goodness that's done."
Absolutely. Yes, exactly.
Wow. Yeah. Two quick questions before we move on. You've interviewed, for example, 6 prime ministers, I think I counted, as I did some research on you. So former prime ministers Whitlam, Fraser, Hawke, Keating, Howard and Kevin Rudd. What leadership qualities did they share?
I think that one of the big leadership qualities, I remember the first time I met John Howard. He was treasurer under Malcolm Fraser, turned up at a function in Brisbane. I was a young reporter there covering the function. He was very friendly, saying hello. And I remember looking at him because there was discussion then about him possibly becoming a leader. And I followed his career, obviously, as a journalist, and he came to the top and he got belted down. He came to the top and there was any number of articles saying, okay, well, John Howard's just been defeated again for leadership. That's the end of John Howard. And he ended up being prime minister because he just persisted. He just kept at it and at it and at it. I think the story of Anthony Albanese coming from, you know, his background, which is, a mum who was disabled and really a very poor background from Housing Commission in Sydney, and he's now Prime Minister. Yeah. And I think that I just admire these people because they do persist. They keep going and going and going, and they all get belted along the way. They all get pushed down along the way, but they persist. And I think it's a great leadership quality to just keep going and persist, because quite often you eventually get there.
Is that one of the – and that's a great answer, because it goes to my next question. What are the qualities that you were teaching your students when you were at RMIT, for example, in terms of, you're going to go into the big, bad, wide world and, you know, not all of you are going to end up being a foreign correspondent or reading the news, for example. What were the key lessons that you were trying to impart to them other than the technical skills of being a good journalist?
Well, I would tell them my story and just say, get your foot in the door no matter where. What I found is that they wanted to go in, a lot of them, and start off by reading the 7 o'clock news. And I'd say, well, no, it doesn't actually work like that. So what I would say to them is you might eventually get there, and some of them actually have, which is fantastic. Yeah. I just say, get your foot in the door and back yourself in. Yeah. Just back yourself in. Sometimes I would have students coming to me saying, I'm not sure if I want to be a journalist anymore and I've made the wrong decision. I said, no, you haven't. Just get this qualification under your belt. Yeah. It's a great qualification. And then look at what else is there for you. So I would try to encourage them, and I'd say, you know, you've got to back yourself. You've got to believe in yourself. And I'd have kids saying, oh, yeah, another person telling us to believe in ourselves. But it's true. You've got to believe in yourself. You've got to know what you want to achieve. And even if you don't know what you want to achieve, you've got to believe in yourself that you will eventually get to where you actually want to go. So it was very much a case of boosting their confidence. They're young, they're smart, they're lovely kids. Trying to say to them, yeah, it is tough to get into the industry. It is tough to get into broadcasting. It is tough to get into journalism. But just have that goal and just keep going. Don't ever get belted back. Don't allow yourself to be surrounded by negative people. Surround yourself with good, positive people who'll pump up your tires, who'll make you feel good. Make sure that you're surrounded by good, strong, positive people. If you've got negative people in your life, well, don't hang around with those people. Hang around with people who are going to support you, who are going to lift you up, and just keep at it. Just keep going. Believe in yourself and go for it.
Your life has been much more than your career, and for those that, you know, might want to Google you, you've been on the other side of the camera as you. So you've obviously had a fascinating and very fulfilling professional career. But when we chatted before this conversation, you said, quote, "Speak up for what is right." So I'd like to change tack now and move away from your journalism and your media training and education career to talk about your own sense of personal leadership and some of the decisions that you've made along the way and your take now on those decisions as you look back on them?
Well, about 16, 17 years ago, Brett and I had been together for many years. I think as a gay person going back 20, 15 years, you accept that you're never going to have a family. You're not going to have kids. I love kids. Most people love kids. I'd always love to have a family, but, you know, I'm gay. So it's simply not going to happen. We noticed at a cafe in Melbourne a gay couple with a baby. And we thought, oh, that's interesting. They must be, you know, doing some babysitting or what's going on here. We asked around and we found that they'd had the baby through surrogacy in the United States. And so Brett and I started discussing the possibility of going through surrogacy. And the more we discussed it, the more we actually wanted to follow it through. We started connecting with people who had actually been through surrogacy. And for probably about a year, we discussed it. Should we do this? Is this the right thing to do? Would we be good parents? Would we be able to cope with one child? Or if we're lucky enough to have two children, you know, would we be able to do that? I'd heard enough stories growing up from people saying that parenting is the toughest job in the world. And when you hear 1,000 people saying parenting is the toughest job in the world, you sort of start to believe them. Mm. And so we discussed it. And by that stage, we'd connected with some really good people who'd been through surrogacy, had, you know, had brought their babies home and raising their kids. And so we decided we'd give it a go. Contacted an organization called Growing Generations in the United States and started going through the process. We decided that we would be good parents, that we would be very focused on our children, that we would do what every other parent does, and we'd give it our best shot. So we started the process with Growing Generations to try and have at least one baby.
And clearly you ended up with a couple.
Clearly.
So we're referring to Daniel and Leah as individuals.
Exactly.
So how did that end? You didn't slip a banana peel and end up with a couple of kids. It was obviously a massive process to go through.
Oh, massive. Look, the paperwork arrives and you could almost jump over the paperwork, and there were police checks and there were health checks and there was all sorts of things. And, you know, it's a very expensive process. And so we had to try and work out how we're going to pay for the whole process. The agency matches you with a surrogate. And we waited and waited and waited, and we hadn't been matched with a surrogate. And finally, we were matched with a wonderful surrogate, Anna, who lived in Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. We then had to find an egg donor. So we went through not traditional surrogacy. We went through gestational surrogacy. So we had a separate egg donor and a separate surrogate. So we had to then find an egg donor. We found a wonderful young egg donor, Jamie, who was then living in New York. A lot of paperwork, a lot of organizing from our end, from the end of the agency. We all met up in Los Angeles, 2016, July 2016, to do the IVF transfer.
2016,
Yep. Oh, 2006.
Six. 2006. The year
fly by,
right?
So, yeah, I missed a decade there. So 2006.
So you're in LA. Freaking out with Brett, or just going, wow, our life's about to
Yeah, it is a bit overwhelming. It is a bit overwhelming because you don't know what's going to happen, and you're just hoping that you're able to have at least one baby. But I mean, at that stage, it is the IVF process, and you're just going through the IVF process. So we meet up and we do the IVF transfer. I think it was on the 3rd of July 2006.
Yep.
And on the 4th of July, we sat there on the balcony of the hotel having a glass of wine, and we were looking at the fireworks over LA, and I was thinking, are these fireworks for us? Is this happening? Is this a sign that it's all going to come together nicely? Little did we know that Anna was downstairs and she was actually pregnant with our twins.
Talk about independence, though. I was about to lose your independence, Dave. Absolutely. I say that as a parent, and I – keep my fondest regards to his lordship. although I was bumped into a new parent the other day, and I said, it's when they start saying, but why? Anyway.
Yes, exactly. But why? But why?
Why?
But why?
Yep. So you're in the States. Life's changing. Are you and Brett literally pinching yourselves, metaphorically going, we're actually, this is happening, this is going to.
Yeah, we've finally got there. We've been through this very, very difficult process. We're finally there.
Yeah.
We have done the transfer, and that's it. There's not much else that we can actually do. Anna heads back to she heads back to Houston. Mm-hmm. Jamie had gone back to New York, and we went to the airport to head back to Australia. Mm-hmm. Get back to Australia, and just waiting for some news. Yeah. And all of a sudden, we get an email from Anna's husband, who said, guess who's going to be the brand new dads on the block?
Oh, wow.
And Brett wasn't there at that stage. And I remember looking at the email, and there was a photo of a pregnancy test, which I'd never seen in my life.
Right.
And I just looked at it, and I was just having this out-of-body experience going, guess who's going to be the new dads? And I went, that must be us. And so Brett's driving home.
Who's going to Long Reach? So
exactly. You know, what's happening here? And so so that was very exciting. And then we're getting information from blood tests that it might actually be, you know, it might be more than one child. Then we find out that it's twins. Then we find out it's a boy and a girl. And it's really just quite overwhelming, because we don't, like any parent who's heading down that path, we don't really know what we're doing. And we're thinking, okay, well, our life is about to change, you know, and change dramatically come 2007, early 2007, expecting the kids in February. But kids come when they decide to come. And and then, you know, 23rd of January, we get a call from our lovely obstetrician who said, I'm sorry, but the kids are on their way. We can't hold it. We're in Australia. Obviously, Anna's in the hospital, and phones us a couple of hours later and says, congratulations, you've got a beautiful little boy and a beautiful little girl.
Wonderful. So jump on a plane and away we go. Was that the
– running around the house like lunatics. And I said to Brett at one stage, what are we running for? It's midday. There's no flights leaving till midday tomorrow.
Right.
Why don't we just stop running around like headless chooks? And and then we had some mates come over, and bottles of champagne, and just calls backwards and forwards from the United States, and then just getting ready to travel over the next day, which was of course leaving around about midday the next day.
Mm. When you step back and look at the decisions that you and Brett made, are there things that, in terms of those lessons that come to mind, or that when you look at your kids, you go, you know, like we have made some very tough decisions here, but some wonderful decisions? Because obviously, you know, they're great kids, and if they do put stuff up on Dad about YouTube,
that's right. Yes,
but it seems to me, knowing you a little bit and having worked with you in a professional context, and getting to know you through this process, that you're the kind of guy who's very courageous, and it would have taken a lot of courage to do things, you and Brett, at a point in time where society was not as inclusive and welcoming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Look, and that's one of the things you discuss when you go into this process. I mean, you know, we get there, you walk into the hospital, here's Daniel in an open crib. You burst into tears because you're just absolutely overwhelmed. You go and see your daughter. She's in a different part of the hospital. You know, more tears. I think for any parent, you're just overwhelmed at what's actually occurred. You're just, I guess any parent at that stage is in a state of shock thinking, wow, look at this. This is just, you know, I often said to people, it was just magic. It was just a magical moment. And when anybody ever says to me, you know, we're pregnant, we're expecting a child, I say to them, when the baby is born, it is pure magic. It will be a magical moment. So you know, but the kids were prem. So we sat there in the hospital for 3 weeks and these wonderful nurses teaching us what we needed to do. But eventually we had to come home, and we came home, and we came back to Melbourne, and you go, wow, what do we do now? Fortunately for me, we decided that that Brett would be the primary carer, former police officer in the Northern Territory for 13 years, very organized, very structured, and, you know, very cluey about what needed to be done. So I was just so lucky to have him to lead the charge in terms of the whole process. But you do the worst thing you could, I think, face as a gay parent is your children being bullied because of who you are.
Right.
And, you know, I feared that, I'd been bullied. I'd been bullied at school, you know, when I was at primary school. My mum died when I was five, and the kids said, "We won't play with you because your mother's dead." I remember this kid said to me one day, "Why would we play with you anymore? You don't even have a mother." And that stuff, that sticks with you for ever. You know, in secondary school, you're bullied and you're beaten up, and and you think, I couldn't stand for my child to be bullied in any way, shape, or form because of who we are. But you know, a lot of these fears are brought along from your experiences, and this is what Brett and I have discussed many times. The fears are there because of our experiences. Actually, when you get into the school system, the parents are great. The parents are just wonderful. The school system is wonderful. The teachers are absolutely sensational. And we've just met some fantastic parents and fantastic teachers. And the whole school process for our kids and for us, I think, has been really, really positive and you know, pleasantly surprised, because I did expect some sort of unpleasantness, but not at all. Actually, quite the contrary. People, when we told them the story of how we brought the kids into the world, were very, very positive, and some people said really encouraging things. So it's been a fantastic experience for any parent. I mean, having children, if you're lucky enough to have one child or two or three or whatever, you know, you're lucky, and it's a fantastic experience. But with us, it was such a difficult journey. I think we just felt so delighted, and then to go through life and go into the school system to watch them grow, to meet other parents, to meet other kids has been terrific. It's been really, really great. We didn't think it would be as good as that. We thought there would be barriers along the way, and there really wasn't.
Your comment about speaking up for what is right, you had to make a tough decision about talking about some of these matters with Brett. Can we just very quickly touch on that? Because when I was talking to you about your story before, it's something that really resonated with me. Obviously, different backgrounds and different stories. Tell us about that, because there were some real challenges that you had and Brett had to decide about.
We decided that when we came home with the kids, that we just wanted to be parents like anybody else, and we didn't want to do much media. Even though I've been involved in media, I thought, no, I'll just, you know, live as a private citizen, if you like. But there was a situation many years ago when the kids were little. A conservative group put out a petition and saying that marriage equality is bad for the nation's health, and it really hurt. You know, it just was awful. And I remember Brett, who doesn't tend to get upset over these things, looking at it in the Age newspaper and just, you know, telling me very bluntly what he thought about the whole thing. And we received a phone call from the 7:30 report saying, did we want to speak about this? And I initially said no. Then I mentioned to Brett that I'd had a call and we'd been offered to speak about it on the 7:30 report. And he said, to my absolute shock, okay, let's go for it. Stuff this. I'm sick of this crap. Let's go for it.
Good on
him. I went, okay, right. So I did exactly what I do with our media training participants. I got us into the office and I worked out the key points that we wanted to put across worked out what we actually wanted to say about all of this, beyond that it was horrible. What were the major messages? The major messages were that these messages going into society from organizations and people like this hurt not only kids who've got gay parents, but hurt every family that doesn't fit into their view of what the perfect family is. I mean, kids are raised by a village. They're raised by grandparents. They're raised by single parents. They're raised by any number of people. And it was just the whole thing was just wrong. So we decided we would do it. Nobody else would speak about it. The ABC said it's going to be a two-camera shoot, which means it's going to be a longer interview, one camera in the front, one camera behind. Worked out the messages, went into it, and basically said just that these messages hurt kids. They hurt our kids and anybody that doesn't fit into what people believe is, you know, the perfect vision of a family. It was broadcast. I remember thinking that day, oh, this is another fine mess I've gotten myself into. But I mean, the core reason behind doing it was basically, and Brett and I discussed this, how can we say to our kids, as we do, that you need to stand up for what is right? You need to stand up against injustice. You need to stick up for those who aren't as powerful as you. You need to do what is correct. And you need to go out there and speak the truth and say clearly and say it from the heart. And I said, well, if we're going to say to our kids that's what you need to do, how can we knock back this opportunity presented by the national broadcaster to put our view across? And so on we went, and it was broadcast, and I expected some unpleasantness, but all we got was support from any number of people. I remember the lovely man who sold us some life insurance before the kids were born, because he wanted to make sure we had all our bases covered. Yeah. He retired years ago. He rang up and said, fantastic, good on you guys. And I thought, wow, you know, it's the power of media. It was a really positive experience. But we just thought, this is what we need to do. We're older gay guys. We need there's going to be a lot of other, you know, people from the LGBTIQ plus community who are going to have children in the years to come. We need to stand up for what is right. We need to speak the truth.
It's, to me, that goes to the adage of you can only be what you can see. You know, so it's encouraging people to, you know, like diversity on TV, for example. Not that it's the same, but it's that kind of broader point. That did you feel that you were doing the right thing by your children and your relationship with Brett, but also you had a responsibility to the broader community to talk about this from a personal perspective?
Yeah, it was like we need to – we'd rather just sit there and raise our kids and not be involved in this stuff, but you need to just speak up. You need to say something. You need to look at what you believe is right when you're offered an opportunity to give your view to a lot of people via a media situation or organization. You need to pick that up. Otherwise, you know, for me, I go back to the days of being bullied by kids and ducking and diving and running away. I mean, you can't run away. You've got to front it, and you've got to go out there and say what you think. If you believe it to be right, you believe it to be true, we'll go out there and speak your truth.
As we begin to close, I'd just like to reflect back on one of the points you made earlier, and that was even as a youngster, you were a vivacious consumer of all things media. What does a day in the life of Doug Weller, media consumer, look like these days? And are there people that you listen to on the radio, for example, or TV and go, yes, you're doing that brilliantly? Like, do you have, well, sure, we all have favourites. My wife would argue that Michael Rowland is probably the worst influence in my life, given the puns. But anyway.
The delightful people, Michael Rowland, lovely man. Delightful.
A lovely man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who will not recall that I met him in one of the more interesting staff of pubs in Canberra about a million years ago, and he was a great guy. He was just a very, very genuine guy.
Genuine guy. Lovely man.
So great, if that's journal, what he is in bloke. Person, I suspect that if that's what he was on air, I suspect I remember meeting him. We could have a bit of a Michael Rowland fan club going on here, except for his puns. But
yes.
Well, we haven't had too many dad jokes in this recording yet. Are there people – so two parts. Are there people that you watch and listen to in media, ABC, commercial, wherever, and go, yes, you are hitting it out of the park, and if so, who are they?
Look, I consume a lot of – news.
Yep.
I don't look at it in terms of they're doing a great job. I look at it in terms of gaining that information. Mm-hmm. But I am very, I think the news presenters on ABC News, 7 o'clock news, do a great job. I think all the ABC News presenters do a great job. I'm a great fan of the ABC. I see the ABC as a trusted news source. I like Lee Sales. I like Sarah Ferguson. You know, I listen to people on radio, not so much because I like them, but I like to listen to what is going on in the media space, because that's my business. I need to advise people about it. I guess I'm more watch, read and listen to gain the news and information than I do actually to look at the personalities. But I do watch and admire people across. I mean, Tracy Grimshaw, terrific. I've seen her conduct fantastic interviews. She's such a good interviewer, just absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. People say, but Current Affair, and I said, but as an interviewer, I think she's possibly one of the best interviewers in the country, because she allows the process to breathe. She doesn't trample over people. She gives them time to speak. And I've watched some of her interviews with very senior people like Oprah Winfrey. A fantastic interviewer. just wonderful. But I'm more keep an eye on media because I'm interested in one, what's going on in the world, and two, the latest media trends, because that's my job, that's my business.
And you need to advise people to on what's going on.
Because people ask me those questions and say, you know, where should I go for news? What should I do with this particular situation? If you're being interviewed by a, you know, senior radio host, that's different to being interviewed by somebody for ABC TV News. Mm. And so, you know, you need to give people advice about those different situations.
So as we wrap it, and again, thank you so much for your time to have this conversation. You know, there's so much to take away and learn from and from you. So taking everything into account so far, what would your 21-year-old self, so there you were walking into that party thinking, who the heck's birthday is this for? So what would 21-year-old self say to you of today, and then what would you now, here in 2022, say to your 21-year-old self?
You're lucky to have this life that you have. Decide what you want to get out of life. Listen to everybody. Listen to people who are older than you. They've got life experience. Yeah. Listen to what they've got to say. Listen to their advice. But then think, really, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to get out of the life that you've been given? What is your North Star? What is your goal? Mm-hmm. What is your vision? Then work that out. Put all the processes you need to put in place achieve it. Surround yourself with positive people. I remember years ago seeing a poster that I bought and had up on my wall for many years, and I still have. It said, it's not what you are, it's what you could be.
Oh, that's great.
So what I would say to my 21-year-old self, the world is your oyster.
Yeah.
Choose what you want to gain. Choose where you want to go. Choose what you want to be. It's not what you are. It's what you want to. Okay. It's what you could be. Right. And then put the processes in place to achieve it. Persist, 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 and never, ever say never. Just keep going, keep going, keep going, and bring your dream to life.
Doug Weller, thank you. Thank you for, being so completely candid and honest in some of those conversations that we've had, but particularly for this episode. Congratulations on a wonderful career. I'm sure you can go and talk to your kids about the judgment of putting Dad on YouTube when he was reading the news.
Yes, I'll have a chat. I'll have a chat to those gorgeous kids of mine. Yes,
and again, a shout out to Brett, Leah and Daniel, but thanks so much for taking the time to be so honest and reflective, and for all the work you've been doing over the many years. And for me, as learning a little bit about you, and particularly taking on what you've been talking about in this conversation, taking those chances, because I think sometimes it's so much easier in life just to go, I won't bother. And for me, listening to your story, it was like, well, if you hadn't being of the mindset to talk to those people and from 4IP that night at the Hamilton Hotel in Brisbane, who knows what would have happened? You probably would potentially still be there, or, you know, being a 3-star Michelin hat chef, who knows? but to me, you've really taken those opportunities, be it, you know, to have worked at TUE, 2GB, ABC throughout the incredible career of yours, and then particularly with Brett having to sit down and going, well, what are we going to do? Let's start our own family, and taking that process further and further and further until you're able now to have a bit of a chuckle about kids. And I say that with affection to them both. So thank you so much for joining us on Dear 21 and Me, and congratulations on a wonderful career, and good luck with the future that I'm sure will be bright for you, Brett, Daniel and Leah.
Thanks, Jeremy. Much appreciated.
Yeah, what a fantastic set of insights there from Doug. A great guy. I've really enjoyed working with Doug. As I said, I've been a client of Doug's in my association career over many years, and an exquisite storyteller. Some of the takeouts from me in that conversation were Doug's resilience and taking those chances when they came to him no matter what, being committed to his family and his own future, and always being grounded. And what a sliding door that moment was
when Doug met those radio folks at that hotel that he talked about in Brisbane. Talk about timing. And as I was saying to Doug after the conversation specifically, had he not been on duty that night, had those folk gone to another hotel, who knows where his career and his life may have turned out. So a huge vote of thanks to Doug for taking the time out to have that chat with me. As I said, I know Doug. I know Doug professionally, and his honesty and his candor and his real vulnerability in that conversation really resonated for me. So thank you so much, Doug, and best of wishes to you, Brett, and your two great kids. All the links from today's conversation are in the show notes, including to Doug reading the ABC 7 p.m. Victoria news. Sure, he was not nervous about that at all. And he's reporting from Washington. Fantastic career he's had over many years. And he's been a key media trainer down here in Melbourne over many, many years, including having been an educator at RMIT. So thanks to the great team here for their work behind the scenes, led by Darcy Milne at Pro Podcast Productions, putting the work in putting the show together, and to Curse the Kids and the Pooch for their support, and to you, most of all, for taking the time out of your day to listen to wherever you are. My thanks. That's it for this episode of Dear 21-Year-Old Me. Stay well, go well. Bye for now.
Thanks for joining us today. For more episodes and links, visit dear21yearoldme.com. And if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.